Hello. Yeah.
Thanks.
Welcome to Never Forget Radio. This episode is called Bono in Paris. It is about football. First, I'd like to thank Tattooed Moms of Philadelphia Podcast Festival, which is Nathan and Tegan over there. Yeah, you guys, thank you for inviting me to do this again. And I want to thank Humble Mumbles, who we just heard. Very good. This is a podcast about 9/11. It's more about its radiating aftermath, the continuing post-9/11 era. So, and we do try to stay away from covering the day itself in order to preserve all of ourselves. But today, through the doctrine of fair use for nonprofit educational purposes, we will be watching some very difficult clips. I hope you'll be surprised by the threads that come out when you start to unravel seemingly straightforward patriotic events, like pregame ceremonies and halftime shows. Today, we attempt to unpack Super Bowl 36, that's XXXVI, staged at the New Orleans Superdome on February 3rd, 2002. We begin with a terrible election. This is a historical meme from the 2004 election. It's a picture of George Bush catching a football and John Kerry failing to catch a football. The caption says, "Do you really want someone who catches like a girl running the United States?" Attacking Kerry's masculinity through this and similar pictures helped define and decide the election. George Bush seemed more approachable, like you could grab a beer with him. Whereas Kerry was some kind of un-American wuss. I mention this story not just anecdotally, but also as an opening reminder that football in America, not just a symbol of masculinity, capitalism, war, and heteronormativity, but a powerful signifier of social normalcy itself. If you laughed at that picture of John Kerry, you participated in this reification of traditional values. Yeah. The Super Bowl is a reification of traditional values, a one-night-only salute to the 20th century American self-image. Some people even watch it for the commercials. This is where the conglomerate's attempt to provide a female-coded, sellable experience to accompany the masculinist blood sport, trying to monetize every possible consumer base. It's the largest event in the American media year, pretty much a national holiday. So these performances we're going to watch today reached a greater audience than all other events previously covered on this pod, like the 9/13 WWF SmackDown and the 2001 World Series. The Super Bowl was conceived as not just a response to the attacks, but as a response to those responses. It took their baseline redemptive patriotism and it went bigger. Later tonight, we'll see its influence stretching all the way to France in 2015. I watched Super Bowl 36. When you're a teenager, you try on a lot of hats. New things, new selves, new ideas. I had already been like, oh, here's what being on the periphery of a traumatic historical event looks like. And not coming from a football family, I guess I was also wondering, what's this football thing all about?
Oh, it's so hard to remember.
Welcome to Never Forget Radio, where, from the comfort of your own home or your device, and from the safety of the future, we can revisit the memory of 9/11 of George W. Bush, and of all the years associated with both sins. It's been over a decade of disappointment, failure, and disaster. I'm no expert, but I'll be your host as we explore our recent past and try to reclaim it. Let's roll.
Before this event even began, 9/11 had lent it special significance. Well, first they changed the logo. Here we can see the updated Super Bowl 36 logo. Then, the newly formed Department of Homeland Security designated Super Bowl 36 a national special security event. This is an official legal status that takes law enforcement responsibility out of the hands of local authorities and gives them to federal agencies. Usually used for political conventions, papal visits, this was the first sports event that received this designation. This is a small thing, but I find significance in the extending of this updated administrative category. It reveals a lot about the fears of the period, people worrying about things like follow-up attacks, suspicious packages, their non-white neighbors. And it also reveals a lot about how that period never really went away. All of the subsequent Super Bowls have been designated national special security events. The Super Bowl is such a production that it gets two whole weeks of media buildup and hours of pregame coverage. Unfortunately, the NFL has taken down the clip that I saw of all the living former presidents reading the Gettysburg Address and the players from the two teams reciting the Declaration of Independence presented by Home Depot. If you are interested in watching that, why not watch this year's Super Bowl? They have recreated that reading of the Declaration of Independence every year since, making it an ongoing tradition like the national anthem. So we start with the national anthem, sung by Mariah Carey.
Keith Lockhart, and the biggest selling female recording artist in history, Mariah Carey.
At this time, I am forced to briefly talk about a famous photograph from 9/11. It depicts three firefighters raising an American flag up a flagpole at Ground Zero. Behind them, a looming tower of rubble extends out of the frame, incomprehensible and out of focus. To me, this image conveys defeat, resignation, acceptance. Like everything about 9/11, this Ground Zero photograph contains multiple meanings, but its immediate and endless association with another flag-raising photo from the 1945 Battle of Iwo Jima has subsumed these possibilities and fixed it with only one single meaning. You'll see in a minute why I'm talking about this. Here is the Iwo Jima photograph. This is from World War II. It signifies striving for victory, success, and glory. To me, these two photographs are not too similar in tone, just in form, the hands straining to reach the flagpole, but they're extremely similar in use. Here we see them both turned into stamps. We also see posters, fundraisers, and statues, like the Marine Corps Memorial in Arlington and the National Fallen Firefighters Memorial in Maryland. And also floats. As you can see here, here's the other float. During Mariah Carey's performance of the national anthem, live actors were featured creating human displays of both of these famous flag-raising photographs, dressed as World War II GIs and as New York City firefighters. You'll be able to see them in the background of her performance coming up. The audience was invited to see themselves as a new greatest generation, skipping ahead from 1945 to 2001, reaching their hands up to join their forefathers in glory. Starting with the Declaration of Independence and continuing with these live reenactments of patriotic photos on wheelable floats, this special security event has spoken very loudly in the new idiom. The new era is going to look remarkably like a small town July 4th parade.
Coming up, we'll have a very special coin toss ceremony.
Unfortunately, I do not have time to show the coin toss, but it was presented by George H.W. Bush. That's what's very special about it. So we must now confront the baby boomers. In 2001, they were in their late 50s, desperate to redeem themselves in the eyes of their dying parents who had fought or been in the home front in World War II, succumbing to nostalgic revisionist history in an intractable, exponential, airport floor escalator-like rightward march. Always to the right. Continuing the pregame festivities after the coin toss, Paul McCartney also appeared. Here he comes running down the field. You see he's making these cutesy movements, like a combination of A Hard Day's Night running from girls and like how a football player moves. It looks like Paul McCartney has been revitalized by these trying times. He's smiling, he's happy, he's jumping around. Like so many, rejuvenated, wakened from sleeping.
America, we love you!
Like a swimmer into cleanness leaping.
Okay, everybody clap your hands for freedom! One, two, three, four! This is my right.
Display flashing in the stadium during this song. I don't know if you've seen it yet. A red light flashing very fast. Freedom! Exclamation point. Like, freedom, 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 freedom. You'll see it if it hasn't come up yet. How should we treat this song? Is it totalitarian? Exploitative? Is it merely embarrassing? There are reasons to defend Paul McCartney for this, especially his traumatic experience of 9/11. He was actually at JFK Airport that morning about to take off, and he watched the attacks through the window of an airplane on the ground. Perhaps the best defense of this song is that it was released very quickly, November 2001, when this was maybe more appropriate. And that all proceeds were donated to the 9/11 victim groups. Perhaps the best condemnation of this song is the lyrics. Freedom, talking about a freedom. You've got to fight for your right to live in freedom. Pause, I guess. This beetle seems to be in the grip of some kind of mania. Post 9/11 mania. During halftime, more on that later, Paul made an appearance in the booth with Fox broadcaster / former quarterback / Newt Gingrich supporter / icon of moronic masculinity, Terry Bradshaw. Those two would have been framed as opposite sides of the 60s culture wars during that decade. Here are some pictures of them from the period. is Terry Bradshaw. But now, decades later, they are indistinguishable guardians of the status quo.
Sir Paul McCartney, listen to you too. I got to ask you. You know what? Now, I understand that what you understand about American football is centered around this guy.
Yeah, I used to watch this man when he had hair.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, you were great, man. With the Steelers, I used to watch him.
Thank you.
Love it.
Mr. McCartney, I appreciate that.
No, I love it.
Paul, let me ask you this. What's in store for you? What's coming up? New CD, new tour?
Yeah, coming around America in April. Going to come from the West Coast to the East Coast and many places in between. Going to rock around America.
And this guy can rock. You know, I grew up with the Beatles. I wish I could grow the hair. I remember all of that. But there's one song, and it kind of like, it's been a hard day's night.
Come on.
I should be working like a log.
I've seen it all.
It's been
now.
A hard day's night. I should be sleeping.
He was cool. I love it.
I sang with a Beatles.
Hey,
life is good.
I know the Beatles.
This isn't the Paul McCartney I remember. What happened? Did he die and they replaced him with somebody? I wish that this 1 minute clip of A Hard Day's Night could have ended all nostalgia for the magic of the 60s forever and buried the cult of the baby boomers. But they live on, undead and expansive, appropriating everything in their wake, rendering the past a shining tool for reactionaries to exploit. But even beyond replacing John Lennon with Terry Bradshaw, there's even more to criticize about the Super Bowl performance. Now we're going to rewind. Notice what is behind Paul as he performs. He manages to rope in a very different 20th century icon to his cause of middle-of-the-road patriotism. This is no mirror picture of the Statue of Liberty. It's a six-story giant scroll hanging by Keith Haring from 1986. Keith Haring in the 1980s, anti-racist, gay artist, and activist, since the 1980s, decontextualized cultural icon. I think that this artwork was included first as literally a picture of the Statue of Liberty and thus freedom, which Paul was singing about. Second, as an attempt to add something, anything of New York to the proceedings in this overwhelming American event. And thirdly, because the artist is famous and his style is instantly recognizable. But unintentionally, the piece also intrudes subtly, stand in a figurant below the level of conscious thought. A mute representative of another tragedy. The primacy of 9/11 in American culture and history speaks to the valuing and devaluing of different kinds of violence done against different kinds of bodies. Keith Haring died of AIDS in 1990. This is sanctimonious of me to put it like this, but here is his work a decade later, not just being used to sell a war, but being used as a backdrop to sell a war. Just a slight extra touch. What this ceremony needs is a pinch of New York City. Get me something famous. For more on this topic, this pod recommends Sarah Shulman's Gentrification of the Mind about AIDS and 9/11. Can we get back to football, please? All right, this is the very short section where we actually talk about the game. At the time of this game, criticisms of football as violent and destructive would have been part of the culture war and would have been dismissed, like John Kerry or me, as liberal, wussy, gay, etc. But a decade later, there's now overwhelming medical evidence of football's deadliness. Star players are retiring early to avoid injury, former players are dying of a brain disease called CTE, and it's now an open question of just how long football will retain its place at the apex of normal, heterosexual, commercial, whatever you want to call it, American identity. The sport may end up becoming a rump pastime, like boxing, faster than you think. So remember today that we're watching a dinosaur in its pomp. Football, television, Bono in a minute, American hegemony, perhaps soon to go extinct. Super Bowl 36 featured the St. Louis Rams, champions 2 years earlier, heavy overdog, versus the New England Patriots, zero previous championships, heavy underdog, whose only advantage seemed to be a meaningful name and red, white, and blue uniforms. The commentators focused on two main narratives, the chemistry, toughness, and teaminess of the Patriots versus the frustration of the Rams, who just could not establish their dominance. The worrying plight of the overdog, the anxious favorite. This seems pretty relevant to the situation in the United States in 2002. By the time of the Super Bowl, Osama bin Laden had already escaped the grasp of the American army at the Battle of Tora Bora, and George Bush was looking for a bigger, more stationary, more traditional opponent, like a country, maybe. But despite being like a giant copper statue swinging its tablet at mosquitoes or whatever, like a big-jawed carnivore troubled by a parasite, Americans did not see themselves in the overdog Rams, but in the resolute against-the-odds Patriots. Those were the rooting interests for neutrals. This is not dissimilar to the we are all New Yorkers, we are all Americans feeling from the same period. Because one team was so heavily favored, and the other had this perfect name and image, viewers were able to vicariously live out their fantasies of victimhood, recovery, togetherness, and overcoming obstacles just by watching this football game. I should mention that the Freedom Fighters, the Patriots, did win the game on a last-minute drive by Tom Brady and a last-second field goal by Adam Vinatieri, instant national heroes whose names still conjure a resigned disgust to any sports fan who's not from New England. But the Patriots were a lot more similar to a non-romantic world power version of America in three important ways. First, they weren't an underdog. After this game, they won more Super Bowls than any other team. Second, their success led to conspiracy theories, like other topics of this podcast. How convenient, people said, or more likely typed, how convenient that the Patriots won the Super Bowl after 9/11. Third, in 2007, they were caught secretly taping their opponents' practices so that they could use their plays in advance. Illegal surveillance. It was called Spygate. A former employee who had switched teams turned them in after they spied on his new team. Who knows how long they'd been doing it? Last year, they were accused of a novel form of cheating in the marvelously named Deflategate. Like the United States, opinion of neutrals has turned against the Patriots since fall 2001. But it's pointless assigning moral roles to sports teams or nations. Although this team had an auspicious name, all teams are Patriots. All wrap themselves in the flag. All take advantage of the rhetoric of soldiers and sacrifice. All are big conservative businesses. And if all teams are Patriots, well, they all cheat, too. From passively accepting or actively encouraging steroid and amphetamine use, to phantom punches, to rigged draft pick lotteries, to database infiltration, to hands of God, or to stealing the catcher's signals from the outfield using a telescope and transmitting them to the dugout by means of a coded buzzer wire, as apparently happened in the 1951 NL Pennant playoff game between the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers, resulting in the shot heard around the world, a walk-off home run. It's amazing that we can still suspend our disbelief about what happens on the field. Okay. Now, the main event. We're going to do this together. The halftime performance by the famous American band, U2. Yep. Bono enters through the crowd. The distance of many years is the only way to deal with things like this.
Someone you could lend a hand in return.
beautiful day. That entrance seems so arrogant. The confident gesticulations, the strutting, the preening, the command, the microphone stuff. Is Bono W? I can see how I thought so when I saw this at TV at 14. Always projecting swagger, Bush finally found a big enough stage after 9/11. Revisit the period as I might, I'm glad that I can't recreate his fatherly immensity. But this is one of the feelings summoned by this massive show, this exuberant conquest. On a bad night, you'd get the sense that Bush was laughing at you, at what he was able to put over on the audience, that he was loving what a great performance he was putting on. I get that from Bono here. An act like this seems too ridiculous for even the actor to take seriously. If the Patriots were emblematic of the post 9/11 era with their secret surveillance of opponents, then you too, in 2014, took it to another level. They released an album, Songs of Innocence, by means of instantly downloading it to every Apple user's account. It just appeared inside your phone like a horror movie where Bono is suddenly in your house. One day I took my phone out of the pocket and this man appeared in my hands. Where it seems like he spontaneously reaches out to touch the camera, which is hovering near his shoulder, and he lingers with it for a minute, like a nice little performative thing. It looks like a sudden impulse. But then it zooms out way too fast, revealing that it was a planned motion, a planned moment, and revealing more about all the work that must go into his every pattern preen, his every look and massive inflection. All of this has been rehearsed. Periodically in this performance, Bono makes a triangle heart with his hands. Is this an expression of sympathy for the survivors of 9/11? No, it's the logo for the band's 2000 to 2001 tour, which you can also see in the stadium shots. The stage is shaped like it. He can't even say thank you. It's got to be, thank you! Thank you for being here with me. Bono has finished singing about how it's a beautiful day. Now behind him is projected September 11th, 2001. Lighting changes and the names of the victims of 9/11 are projected behind the band, separated by categories, each numbered plane, then the emergency response services, then the rest. Someone has made the incredibly smart decision to project these names in three columns, not two. And the light projecting the names comes from the front of the stage, so it covers U2's faces first. Bono intermediates with the victims, and they must pass across his face and body before we are allowed to see them.
America!
Bono's got his head bowed. He does this slow, significant walk. And he calls out a question. America? and stops. But I guess the question is more, are you ready for me to scream at you? Then he starts his victory lap around the stage. He's making these like stylized cartoon running movements with his hands. Like, here he comes. Whoa, whoa, gotta stop. Gotta slow down with my arms. He's like drawing motion lines around himself. He does these like passion grimaces and slow motion shoulder rolls. We've spoken before about the use of the names, the people lumped together, thousands of individuals used for singular evil purposes. Here that is again. It's the form of the Vietnam Memorial that should have been influential. The gash in the earth, the black stone, the lack of heroism, the admitting of fault. Not just the repetition of the names. Instead, what started as a unique acknowledgement ended up as de-individualized exploitation. 9/11 memorials and ceremonies are so often mimicry of the Vietnam original without its content, like sequels or spin-offs, just like the post-9/11 wars. And bizarrely, which you'll see in a minute, the banner collapses. I always notice this type of motion, incongruous, repeated, the repetition and actual effect of the attacks, the collision, explosion, and collapse, seared into our heads and repeated everywhere, even unintentionally in tributes like these. By some oversight, the banner with the names collapse, like the buildings with the people in them, and we're left only with the bitter aftermath. You too. And if you look at the names, they're in alphabetical order. It doesn't look like they finish the names when they collapse the screen that they're projected onto. You can see sometimes they're only up to C. You can see there. All 3,000 honored dead could not fit in within the advertiser time slots of halftime. They only had a certain amount of time, and they went for effect, not honor. We'll just turn it back up. Finale, the frankly lascivious Bono makes that heart symbol again with his hands over his stomach. It's very uncomfortable. Then he pulls weirdly at his jacket, revealing stars and stripes lining his every moment icky. He holds it and then begins clapping for himself. Like many things about the post 9/11 era, U2 seems beyond parody. There's no America, only Americana. The Super Bowl performance came at the end of a tour of the U.S. that they'd previously scheduled for fall 2001. And when they played New York in October, they projected the names of the dead there and brought emergency workers on stage. That performance is why Fox's executives invited them to recreate it at the Super Bowl. But a lot happened between October 2001 and February 2002, like a war. Any defense of U2 based on the time or based on their 80s activism or charitable buzzwording would fall apart with this implicit endorsement of the post-9/11 American wars. in light of what happened afterwards, it's not hard to see these performances as a commercial decision in band or brand evolution. From then on, U2 had joined the tragedy circuit. 3 years after this game, the New Orleans Superdome became a refugee camp for people fleeing the rising waters of Hurricane Katrina. Again, we have to confront what and who are valued by the state. After flooding and roof damage, after death and disaster, after reports that white tourists were smuggled out before the bulk of people were evacuated, did they close the Superdome? Did they demolish it and build a memorial? Last time I checked, they built 7 new World Trade Centers. They restored the Superdome with $300 million in public money and added new luxury suites. And though the city was devastated, the stadium reopened in time for the 2006 football season, a year after the hurricane. U2 performed at the first game at the Superdome after Hurricane Katrina, and they brought Green Day. Let's go to the video. Okay, I'm not going to show this video. We've been through a lot already today. Because they had healed America at the Super Bowl after 9/11, U2 was the tenuous link that allowed the stagers of this post-Katrina event to appeal to those nostalgic post-9/11 feelings rather than focus on the specific horrors that had happened in the stadium itself. By 9/11-ifying the hurricane, it became a non-specific obstacle to be redemptively risen from, not a very, very specific preventable result of systemic racism and government failure. Because the Louisiana public participated in the restoration of the Superdome's profitability with their tax money, it's already hosted another Super Bowl and a WrestleMania. And it's been renamed the Mercedes-Benz Superdome. By contrast, the St. Louis Rams no longer exist because they couldn't wheedle enough money out of the city after the Black Lives Matter protests after Ferguson to build a new stadium in St. Louis. So this year, they moved the team to L.A. That's the end of the story for today about the Super Bowl and the Superdome. The only remaining loose end is U2 and the endless post-9/11 era. In November 2015 in Paris, along with an attack at the Eagles of Death Metal concert at the rock club Bataclan, bombs were set off at the international soccer game between France and Germany at the Stade de France. Terrorism is far older than the Islamic State or Bin Laden. But the anarchists who bombed Wall Street September 16, 1920, would never have thought to target the World Series, which opened in Brooklyn 2 weeks later, October 5th, 1920. Those worlds were not connected. Sports was grubby, lower class, men fought, grandstands collapsed. But after the brutal monetization of the 20th century, these once polar symbolic worlds, pastoral romantic Ebbets Field and Heart of the Beast Wall Street, have long since melded. Now, after a decade and a half of sports and entertainment events as patriotic events, they've actually become targets of conventional terrorists who fit conventional media narratives about terrorism. They became so nationalistic that they became real symbols, not fake symbols, of the nation in a cycle of escalation. After the 2015 attacks, the French recovery narrative was partially located in sports, when France made the final of the 2016 European Soccer Championships in the same stadium that had been attacked 9 months earlier. But like 9/11, Katrina, Boston, the recovery narrative also played out in music. Naturally, Bono performed in Paris after the 2015 attacks.
Bonsoir, Paris! Oh, we are in Paris. Feels like the whole world is in Paris. Tonight, we are all Parisians. Ce soir, nous sommes tous Parisiens, non? If you love liberty, then Paris is your hometown. We have few words to speak to the loss that you are feeling in this city tonight. Even if we think we know a little something about grief, I guess grief is like a wound that never fully closes. I am still feeling it. And I was 14.
All right. U2 is an easy target. But what I'd like to say is that any band, even a culturally approved one, performing at a stage like this, at a time like this, would become monstrous, disrespectful, ugly. All of these things, sports, corporate sports, nationalism, frontmen, they were all already toxic. And it's almost that the disasters that convened them in the clips that we've seen today didn't even make them any worse. Although they're the topics of this podcast, 9/11, the post-9/11 era, they're not especially significant or separatable from our culture, our nation, our awful history. Sacrifice, honor, respect. So much of the post-9/11 era is just tone policing. At Super Bowl 36, the advertiser's halftime schedule and the light show didn't leave enough time to project all of the names of the honored dead. Big disrespect. Of course, this podcast is again attempting to walk a line between calling a response to 9/11 incredibly disrespectful while itself likely being incredibly disrespectful, or at least childishly left. But the incomplete list of names and Bono's absurd strutting and his American flag coat lining, this should have blown away all possibility of taking this seriously. Even before they repeated this act on two other stages over a decade and a half of tragedy, Bono's appearance at the Super Bowl in 2002 should have ended the post-9/11 era right there. But instead, they melded the victims into their brand. In an art museum, in a textbook, up on a marble column, the ancient kings always look ridiculous. In their headdresses, in their knee breeches, in their powdered wigs, their high collars, in their complex sideburns, in their top hats, skinny ties, draper gray suits, in their tights, shoulder pads, and helmets, in their leather jackets with stars and stripes lining. I wish that instead of victories and invasions, voyages, coronations, and buried genocides, history was a record of overswelling pompous idiots, imploding in great bursts of public embarrassment, followed by healing group laughter. But the best we have is anecdotes. Among the solemnity every year, you can remember this too. Bono in New York, Bono in New Orleans, Bono in Paris. Never forget. Forget Radio is a production of Book Style Publications, located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Music by Old Cable. Thanks to Nathan Karuna, Tegan Keating, Tattooed Moms, Rebecca Catherine Hirsch, Emily Beek, Gabe Dills, Corey Bekele, Sammy Schuster, and Eli Schuster Bekele. Send your sports feelings to Never Forget Radio on Bandcamp, Gmail, Tumblr, or Never Forget Pod on Twitter. Today's quotes are from newspaper articles about the National League pennant playoff game by Red Smith in the New York Herald Tribune, October 4th, 1951. Now it is done. Now the story ends. And there is no way to tell it. The art of fiction is dead. Reality has strangled invention. Only the utterly impossible, the inexpressibly fantastic, can ever be plausible again. And the second quote is by Sephora Smith, New York Times, December 7th, 2015.
Bono made repeated references to Paris throughout the show, as huge screens in the background showed the names of the November 13th victims. A few fans apparently were deterred from attending the rescheduled shows. Lee Valmink, 19, a student, said she was proud to attend. "It's how we can fight terrorism, by continuing to go to concerts. I feel it's our duty to be here. Thank you, and never forget."